Science Podcast, a weekly roundup of science coverage from NPR. I'm Andrew Prince, a web producer with the Science Desk. It was Nobel Week this week, and the prizes were awarded for research into in vitro fertilization, a new form of carbon, and an organic chemistry reaction. We'll bring you stories of each of them, as well as stories about novel ways that neurons communicate, and one of America's most important crops, corn. First up, though, the Nobel Prize for Physiology or Medicine. It's been more than 30 years since Louise Joy Brown became the first test tube baby, and one of the scientists who made Brown's existence possible was awarded the Nobel this year. That was Robert Edwards. He's a physiologist at Cambridge University in the UK, and he received the $1.5 million prize in physiology or medicine for his work on in vitro fertilization. NPR's John Hamilton reports that IVF caused a huge controversy, but has produced more than 4 million babies so far.
Louise Brown was conceived in a dish using an egg from her mother and sperm from her father. The fertilized egg was placed in her mother's uterus, and Louise arrived by C-section in 1978 with a film crew in attendance. Patrick Steptoe, the gynecologist who was Robert Edwards' main collaborator, described her birth.
We don't want the first breath to inhale any of this fluid. A good, healthy cry.
That cry was a scientific milestone, a baby born to a couple who would otherwise have been unable to have a child. And it was a cry that would echo around the world as people debated whether scientists were tinkering inappropriately with life itself. Edwards and Steptoe knew their work would be disturbing to many people. Steptoe died in 1988, and Edwards, who is 85, isn't granting interviews anymore. But in 2001, after he won the Lasker Award, Edwards said he and Steptoe had decided not to let public opinion slow them down.
We agreed, before we touched a patient, that we would stop if we thought any damage had been done to the mother, the father, or the child. But we would not accept religious objections that weren't defined, or political objections that weren't defined, or personal insults, which we got in plenty.
The Catholic Church objected, saying science shouldn't separate sex from procreation. Some scientists worried that IVF babies would be abnormal or unhealthy. But that didn't happen. Alan Penzias of Harvard Medical School and Boston IVF says these days IVF has wide support.
The voices that you hear, all the cheering in the background, not only are the 4 million babies born due to IVF and their 8 million parents, but every reproductive medicine specialist who can sit across the desk, look at a patient in the eye and said, congratulations, you're pregnant today because of IVF.
IVF now accounts for more than 1% of babies born in the U.S. and many other nations. And Penzia says the work of Edwards and Steptoe is why we're grappling with another promising but controversial technology.
The understanding of how eggs and embryos grow in a dish also led to the stem cell lines that exist today.
And IVF has led to a whole new set of treatments for infertility. Roger Lobo at Columbia University is president of the American Society for Reproductive Medicine. He says those new treatments include
injection of sperm into the egg, which is called ICSI, which allows male infertility to be treated, genetic diagnosis, what we call PGD,
and freezing embryos for later use. Dr. Randi Hutter-Epstein recently published a history of childbirth called Get Me Out. She says society's gradual acceptance of IVF has been pretty typical for a new reproductive technology, whether it's the tools used to deliver babies, hormone treatments, or choosing one embryo over another.
Everything we do is considered horrible and weird and scary. And then when it works, because so many couples are desperate to have a baby, we just go with it.
And Hutter-Epstein says that won't stop with new ways to get pregnant.
We think, oh, it's terrible that we're going to pick a child because it's a boy or it has blue eyes. And if we can figure out how to do it, sure. I think we're going to go with whatever technology is available.
Hutter-Epstein says the one limiting factor is cost. And she says for IVF, that's typically tens of thousands of dollars. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The Physics Nobel from the Royal Swedish Academy was next out of the gate. And the star of the physics world is a new form of carbon, graphene. It's the world's thinnest material, also, perhaps, the strongest. The two scientists who discovered graphene in 2004 have won this year's Nobel Prize for Physics. But among non-physicists, the leader of the team may already be more famous for one of his laboratory tricks, using magnets to levitate a frog. NPR's Dan Charles has more.
You don't get a Nobel Prize for tricks with frogs. For that, there's the Ig Nobel Prize, devoted to silly science. And Andrei Geim, a Russian-born physicist at the University of Manchester in England, has now become the first scientist to win both. He won his Ig Nobel 10 years ago. Geim told everyone at the Ig Nobel Award ceremony that levitating a frog led to lots of requests, including one from the leader of a small religious group in England.
Who offered us £1 million if we could levitate him in front of his congregation to improve his public relations, apparently.
There was a real point to the frog experiment, which is why pictures of it are in lots of physics textbooks. It demonstrates a phenomenon called diamagnetism. Diamagnetic materials, like water, are pushed away by magnetic fields, so a really powerful magnetic field can hold up a frog, which is mostly water.
He's just exceptionally creative.
Alan McDonald, professor of physics at the University of Texas in Austin, is a longtime admirer of Geim's work.
He's always looking for something new, and wanting to be creative is not enough. He just has tremendous intuition.
That intuition came into play in the discovery of graphene. 6 or 7 years ago, Geim and a more junior colleague, Konstantin Novoselov, took a block of graphite, the same material that's in the center of a pencil, stuck some scotch tape to it, then pulled the tape off. Graphite is made from billions of layers of carbon atoms laid on top of each other. Geim and Novoselov thought that maybe the tape would pull off just a few of these layers, maybe even just one. Amazingly, the Scotch tape method worked. And in October of 2004, the two scientists announced they'd managed to create single sheets of carbon, just one atom thick. Physicist Philip Kim at Columbia University remembers reading the paper and feeling scooped.
Oh, no, that it worked out in this way. That was my probably reactions. Some such a simple things, scotch tape.
Kim had been trying to do the same thing using more high-tech methods. All of these scientists wanted to get their hands on super thin layers of carbon because they were pretty sure that this new material, graphene, would exhibit some remarkable physical behavior.
Things are special in two dimensions.
Alan McDonald from the University of Texas points out that in graphene, electrons cannot move up or down. They can only move around this flat sheet, and suddenly they move differently, at a constant speed, more like light. But graphene also has more practical properties. It's stronger than steel, a superb electrical conductor, and it's transparent. Scientists speculate it may eventually be useful in all kinds of electrical devices, from mobile phones to computer chips. Andrei Geim said today he's not too concerned about all these future uses. In fact, he told the BBC accepting his Ig Nobel Prize showed more courage.
I'm proud that we did take this prize, and we have shown enough sense of humor and irony about our own work.
Geim says it won't take much courage to accept a Nobel Prize. He and Konstantin Novoselov will receive their awards in Stockholm in December. Dan Charles, NPR News, Washington.
And we'll wrap up our coverage of the Science Nobels with chemistry. Thinner computer screens, better antibiotics, and new cancer drugs. These are all things made possible by the work that earned three organic chemists this year's Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Working independently, the trio came up with ways to link carbon atoms together, so that complex organic molecules can be made in the lab. NPR's Joe Palca has our report.
Sometimes scientists know when they've been nominated for the Nobel Prize. Aish Nagishi of Purdue University knew, and today he got the call.
This is a, of course, major surprise, but not a complete surprise.
But lots of people get nominated each year, and there are always many worthy candidates. At a press conference at Purdue University this morning, Nagishi described a conversation he had had just last night.
I was telling my wife, maybe 1 in 100. 1 in 100, that means there are 99 chance for this not coming.
Nagishi shares the prize with Richard Heck, who's now retired from the University of Delaware, and Akira Suzuki, an emeritus professor at Hokkaido University in Sapporo, Japan. The award was for their work on palladium-catalyzed cross-couplings in organic synthesis. It's not easy work to describe. At no point during the 45-minute press conference did anyone ask a question directly related to Nagishi's Nobel work.
One of the things that chemistry is fundamentally about is how to make new molecules and how to make new materials.
Joseph Francisco is a colleague of Nagishi's at Purdue and the president of the American Chemical Society. Basically, these three chemists used the metal palladium as a catalyst. Catalysts are a little like matchmakers. They bring atoms together that probably wouldn't get together on their own.
That actually makes it very easy to make new bonds and connect atoms and connect various groups to make new compounds.
These new compounds have had a variety of applications, from medicine to electronics. Winning the Nobel Prize doesn't just validate a scientist's work. It turns them into something special.
I can begin sensing its enormous impact. And at the same time, I've begun feeling my responsibility as well, which will be enormously increased.
The Nobel Prize means Eish Nagishi is now someone people will turn to for all sorts of answers, not just about how to make complex organic molecules. Joe Palca, NPR News, Washington.
Researchers may finally have a better explanation for problems like epilepsy and chronic pain, which have baffled the scientific world for decades. The explanation involves a new discovery about how nerve cells communicate, and it's based on the work of a scientist who kept asking basic questions, even as he approached his 100th birthday. NPR's John Hamilton has the story.
The scientist's name was Ichiji Tasaki, and he came to the National Institutes of Health in the 1950s. Peter Basser became Tasaki's boss about 10 years ago. He says Tasaki had a sharp mind and strong body well into his 90s.
He would walk back and forth to his house with his wife, who helped him in the laboratory every day, 7 days a week. He was here on the weekends. He was here when it was snowing. He was an amazing man.
Tasaki was determined to learn everything he could about how nerve cells transmit messages. Meanwhile, a much younger NIH researcher named Doug Fields was trying to understand something odd. Most scientists thought nerve cells only sent messages across a junction known as a synapse. But Fields was doing experiments that suggested nerve cells were communicating with other cells without using a synapse.
How was that happening? How could you have signaling from neurons to cells that are not neurons when our understanding of how signaling works is all based on synapses? So that's the mystery.
Then one day, Fields found a clue. He calls up a video on his computer. It shows an axon, the long, slender projection from a nerve cell that carries electrical impulses to the synapse.
I was playing back a movie of an experiment in the lab in which I had stimulated the axon to fire impulses. And in that recording, I saw this. The axon moved. It twitched.
When Fields saw the twitch, he was puzzled. Then he remembered that not far from his office was a man who could help him understand what he was seeing, Dr. Tasaki.
Dr. Tasaki measured these mechanical changes in all kinds of tissue, in the retina, in skin. He even showed that the whole spinal cord of a frog twitched when an axon fired.
Dr. Tasaki told Fields that the twitch could be part of a communication system that sends a chemical messenger directly to another cell. And he helped Fields design experiments that would show whether that system existed. One of them used a high-tech microscope equipped with night vision technology. Fields put it in a plywood box he built himself to keep out all light.
It looks a little bit like a prop for a magician, doesn't it? A black box.
So you've got the combination of like the world's latest technology inside a box you built in your garage.
It looks kind of crude.
Fields suspected that when a nerve cell's axon twitches, it opens a channel in the cell membrane, and a chemical called ATP escapes. His black box gave him a way to test this idea. The experiment used a dish containing nerve cells and all but one of the chemicals that allow fireflies to light up the summer sky. The missing chemical was ATP, which was trapped inside each neuron. Fields demonstrates the experiment.
Stimulate the neuron, and if it releases ATP, we should see a burst of photons. So here we go. Stimulate the neuron, and there's a burst of photons, meaning ATP has been released.
Other experiments confirm that twitching axons were indeed releasing ATP, and maybe other neurotransmitters too. No synapse needed. Fields says this new system of cell communication does a better job explaining problems like chronic pain and epilepsy. Both involve nerve cells firing when they shouldn't, and studies show that this firing isn't triggered by signals coming across synapses. Doug Fields says it could be triggered by twitching axons releasing ATP. He says the system also may be involved in controlling blood flow and the formation of myelin insulation around nerves. Peter Basser says even though that's still just speculation, Fields' approach represents a big step forward.
The genius of Doug's work is that he's been able to use this basic research that Dr. Tasaki did and show its biological relevance.
When Fields finished his paper on ATP, he eagerly walked it over to Dr. Tasaki's office. But he was too late. Dr. Tasaki had died a few weeks earlier at the age of 98. The research based on his work appears in the journal Science Signaling. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Finally this week, we'll talk corn. According to a report in this week's journal Science, genetically modified corn has dramatically reduced populations of a common corn-eating worm. That's put more money in farmers' pockets, and paradoxically, most of the financial benefit went to farmers who did not grow these new kinds of corn. NPR's Dan Charles has the story.
The insect is called the European corn borer. This little worm, which also turns into a moth for part of its life, hitched a ride to the New World on a ship from Europe in 1917. It loves corn and quickly spread across corn-growing areas of the Midwest. Every year, scientists from the U.S. Department of Agriculture went into cornfields and counted those worms.
And amazingly, these data sets were basically just sitting in filing cabinets.
William Hutchinson is an insect specialist at the University of Minnesota. He and a group of colleagues pulled out those files and took a closer look. For most of the past 50 years, he says, there was a regular pattern to the corn borer infestation.
About every 6 to 7 years, there'd be an outbreak, and then they would naturally decline.
But starting 14 years ago, corn borer populations started falling, and the occasional big outbreaks stopped. Hutchinson says there's a simple reason. Also 14 years ago, farmers started growing corn that contains a new gene inserted in the laboratory. This genetically engineered corn is poison to corn borers, so when they start feeding, they die. The gene came from a kind of bacteria called Bacillus thuringiensis, or BT, so the corn is known as BT corn, and it's extremely popular.
We're up to about 63% of the total U.S. acres. So about 55 million out of 88 million acres are now BT corn.
Hutchinson and his colleagues estimate farmers made $7 billion in extra profits over the past 14 years because fewer worms were eating their corn. What's more surprising, the biggest boost in profits was from the fields of conventional corn. Those fields also had fewer worms because all the BT corn planted nearby had killed them off. But farmers growing traditional corn didn't have to pay for the BT corn seed, which is more expensive.
The non-BT acres are actually receiving about two-thirds of the total $7 billion benefit.
It's a little like if everyone around you gets a flu shot, they're less likely to infect you with the flu. You get the benefit without the pain. Now, there's a reason why Hutchinson and some of his colleagues are highlighting the money farmers can earn by planting conventional corn. They want farmers to keep planting it. Because if farmers planted only genetically engineered corn, you'd be more likely to see a new kind of corn borer emerge, one that's resistant to the effects of BT. Bruce Tabashnik at the University of Arizona says it's not just a theoretical danger.
There are some other situations where insects have evolved resistance to BT crops, including BT corn.
For instance, in Puerto Rico, farmers once planted almost 100% BT corn, and insects called fall armyworms used to die when they ate it. Now they don't. To help keep the same thing from happening here, farmers in the U.S. already are supposed to plant conventional corn on at least 10% of their acres. These are so-called refuges where corn borers can live in peace. But some farmers don't do it. Tabashnik, who was not involved in the study released today, says this research could help persuade more farmers that it's not just a good idea to plant conventional corn, it's profitable.
It's a wonderful result. This example's kind of the poster child for a case where resistance has not evolved. And hopefully some of the lessons learned from this case can be exported and encourage growers more generally, globally, to adopt the refuge strategy.
Some farmers, in fact, seem to figure this out on their own. There are reports that demand for BT corn has now leveled off. But even when farmers want to move away from BT corn, it's not always easy for them to do it. Seed companies, the big ones are Monsanto and DuPont, now sell seeds that contain lots of different traits. Sometimes, if farmers want one of those genes, one that kills the corn rootworm, for instance, they also get the ones they may not want, such as the BT gene that kills the European corn borer. Dan Charles, NPR News, Washington.
That's it for this week's On Science podcast. Head over to our website, where you can find videos of those levitating frogs from the experiments of the Physics Nobel Prize winner. He also levitated a tomato, just for good measure. And yes, we've got that one online too. You can find those clips and all of NPR's science coverage at npr.org/science. I'm Andrew Prince.